Nazi elite in 1988 with the publication of his critical biography, Little Heart and the Weight of History. In it, he asserts that the revered British military theorist Sir Basil H. Little Heart was wrong on basic strategic questions of the period between the First and Second World Wars, especially in his opposition to the use of military force against the Third Reich, and was a de facto appeaser even after evidence had surfaced about the systematic murder of Jews. Mearsheimer expected that his perspective would draw fire from British reviewers who had been close to Little Heart, which it did. Other political scientists work on capillaries. John goes for the jugular, notes Richard Rosecrans, a retired professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, who mentored Mearsheimer in the 1970s. Mearsheimer certainly triggered a bloodbath with a 2006 article that became a 2007 book written with the Harvard professor Stephen M. Walt and dedicated to Huntington, the Israel lobby and U.S. foreign policy, which alleges that groups supportive of Israel have pivotally undermined American foreign policy interests, especially in the run-up to the Iraq War. Some critics, like the Johns Hopkins University professor Elliot Cohen, accused Mearsheimer and Walt outright of anti-Semitism, noting that their opinions had won the endorsement of the white supremacist David Duke. Many others accused them of providing potent ammunition for anti-Semites. A former Chicago colleague of Mearsheimer labeled the book piss-poor monocausal social science. Last fall, Mearsheimer re-energized his critics by favorably blurbing a book on Jewish identity that many commentators denounced as grotesquely anti-Semitic. The blurb became a blot on Mearsheimer's judgment, given the book's author's revolting commentary elsewhere, and was considered evidence of an unhealthy obsession with Israel and Jewishness on Mearsheimer's part. The real tragedy of such controversies, as lamentable as they are, is that they threaten to obscure the urgent and enduring message of Mearsheimer's life's work, which topples conventional foreign policy shibboleths and provides an unblinking guide to the course the United States should follow in the coming decades. Indeed, with the most critical part of the world, East Asia, in the midst of an unprecedented arms race fed by acquisitions of missiles and submarines, especially in the South China Sea region, where states are motivated by old-fashioned nationalism rather than universal values, and with the Middle East undergoing less a democratic revolution than a crisis in central authority, we ignore Mearsheimer's larger message at our peril. In fact, Mearsheimer is best known in the academy for his equally controversial views on China, and particularly for his 2001 magnum opus, The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. Writing in Foreign Affairs in 2010, the Columbia University professor Richard K. Betts called Tragedy one of the three great works of the post-Cold War era, along with Francis Fukuyama's The End of History and The Last Man, 1992, and Huntington's The Clash of Civilizations and the Remaking of World Order, 1996. And, Betts suggested, once China's power is full-grown, Mearsheimer's book may pull ahead of the other two in terms of influence. The Tragedy of Great Power Politics truly defines Mearsheimer, as it does realism. Mearsheimer sat me down in his office, overlooking the somber collegiate Gothic structures of the University of Chicago, and talked for hours, over the course of several days, about tragedy and his life. One of five children in a family of German and Irish ancestry, and one of the three who went to service academies, Mearsheimer graduated from West Point in the bottom third of his class, even after he fell in love with political science in his junior year. He got his master's degree at the University of Southern California while stationed nearby in the Air Force, and went to Cornell for his doctorate. I disagreed with almost everything I read. I venerated nobody. I found out what I thought by what I was against. After stints at the Brookings Institution and Harvard, he went to the University of Chicago in 1982 and has never left. Whereas Harvard, at least in Mearsheimer's telling, is inclined to be a government policy shop with close ties to Washington, the University of Chicago comes closer to a pure intellectual environment. At Harvard, many students and faculty members alike are on the make, networking for that first or next position in government or the think tank world. The environment is vaguely unfriendly to theories or bold ideas, Huntington being the grand exception that proves the rule. After all, social science theories are gross simplifications of reality. Even the most brilliant theories can be right, say, only 75% of the time. Critics unfailingly seize on any theory's shortcomings, damaging reputations. So, the truly ambitious tend to avoid constructing one. The University of Chicago, set off the beaten path in a society dominated by bi-coastal elites, explains Mearsheimer, has always attracted oddballs with theories, political scientists who, while deeply respected, are at the same time not truly embraced by the American academic power structure. These iconoclasts have included Hans Morgenthau, as well as Leo Strauss, another German-Jewish refugee, whom some link with neoconservatism. Realists especially have been outsiders in a profession dominated by liberal internationalists and others to the left. For Mearsheimer, academia's hostility to realism is evident in the fact that Harvard, which aims to recruit the top scholars in every field, never tried to hire the two most important realist thinkers of the 20th century, Morgenthau and Kenneth Waltz. But at Chicago, a realist like Mearsheimer, who loves teaching and never had ambitions for government service, can propound theories and unpopular ideas and revel in the uproar they cause. Whatever the latest groupthink happens to be, Mearsheimer almost always instinctively wants to oppose it, especially if it emanates from Washington. The best grand theories tend to be written no earlier than middle age, when the writer has life experience and mistakes behind him to draw upon. Morgenthau's 1948 classic, Politics Among Nations, was published when he was 44, Fukuyama's The End of History was published as a book when he was 40, and Huntington's Clash of Civilizations as a book when he was 69. Mearsheimer began writing The Tragedy of Great Power Politics when he was in his mid-40s, after working on it for a decade. Published just before 9/11, the book intimates the need for America to avoid strategic distractions and concentrate on confronting China. A decade later, with the growth of China's military might vastly more apparent than it was in 2001, and following the debacles of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, its clairvoyance is breathtaking. Tragedy begins with a forceful denial of perpetual peace in favor of perpetual struggle, with great powers primed for offense, because they can never be sure how much military capacity they will need in order to survive over the long run. Because every state is forever insecure, Mearsheimer counsels, the internal nature of a state is less important as a factor in its international behavior than we think. Great powers are like billiard balls that vary only in size, he intones. In other words, Mearsheimer is not one to be especially impressed by a state simply because it is a democracy. As he asserts early on, whether China is democratic and deeply enmeshed in the global economy or autocratic and autarkic will have little effect on its behavior, because democracies care about security as much as non-democracies do. Indeed, a democratic China could be more technologically innovative and economically robust, with consequently more talent and money to lavish on its military. A democratic Egypt, for that matter, could create greater security challenges for the United States than an autocratic Egypt. Mearsheimer is not making moral judgments. He is merely describing how states interact in an anarchic world. Face it, Mearsheimer says in his book, quoting the historian James Hudson, "The world is a brutal, amoral cockpit." To make sure readers get the point, he taps the British scholar E.H. Carr's 1939 book, The 20 Years Crisis, 1919-1939, which takes a wrecking ball to liberal internationalism. One of its main points, whatever moral issues may be involved, There is an issue of power which cannot be expressed in terms of morality. To wit, in the 1990s, we were able to intervene to save lives in the Balkans only because the Serbian regime was weak and had no nuclear weapons, against a Russian regime that was at the same time committing incalculable human rights violations in Chechnya. We did nothing, just as we did nothing to halt ethnic cleansing in the Caucasus. States take up human rights only if doing so does not contradict the pursuit of power. But being a realist is not enough for Mearsheimer. He needs to be an offensive realist, as he calls himself. Offensive realism, he writes in Tragedy, is like a powerful flashlight in a dark room. It cannot explain every action throughout hundreds of years of history, but he exhaustively goes through that history to demonstrate just how much it does explain. Whereas Hans Morgenthau's realism is rooted in man's imperfect nature, Mearsheimer's is structural, and therefore that much more inexorable. Mearsheimer cares relatively little about what individual statesmen can achieve, for the state of anarchy in the international system simply guarantees insecurity. Compared with Mearsheimer, Henry Kissinger and the late American diplomat Richard Holbrook, two men usually contrasted with each other, are one and the same, romantic figures who believe they can pivotally affect history through negotiation. Kissinger, in fact, has written lush histories of statesmen in A World Restored, Metternich, Castlereagh, and The Problems of Peace, 1812 to 1822, 1957, and Diplomacy, 1994, embracing his subjects with charm and warmth, whereas Mearsheimer's Tragedy is cold and clinical. Kissinger and Holbrook care deeply about the contingencies of each situation and the personalities involved. Mearsheimer, who was always good at math and science in school, sees only schemata, even as his own historical analyses have helped to rescue political science from the purely quantitative studies favored by others in his field. Just as Mearsheimer's theory of realism is opposed to Morgenthau's in being structural, it is also opposed to the structural realism of Columbia's Waltz in being offensive. Offensive realism posits that status quo powers don't exist. All great powers are perpetually on the offensive, even if obstacles may arise to prevent them from expanding their territory or influence. What was Manifest Destiny, Mearsheimer asks the reader, except offensive realism? Indeed, the United States was bent on establishing regional hegemony, and it was an expansionist power of the first order in the Americas. Acquiring territory from European powers, massacring the native inhabitants, and instigating war with Mexico, in good part for the sake of security. Mearsheimer details Japan's record of aggression in Korea, China, Russia, Manchuria, and the Pacific Islands after its consolidation as a nation-state following the 19th century Meiji Restoration. To demonstrate that the anarchic structure of the international system, not the internal characteristics of states, determines behavior, he shows how Italy, during the 8 decades that it was a great power, was equally aggressive under both liberal and fascist regimes, going after North Africa, the Horn of Africa, the Southern Balkans, southwestern Turkey, and southern Austria-Hungary. He characterizes Germany's Otto von Bismarck as an offensive realist who engaged in conquest during his first 9 years in office and then restrained himself for the next 19. In fact, that restraint was because Bismarck and his successors correctly understood that the German army had conquered about as much territory as it could without provoking a great power war, which Germany was likely to lose. But when Mearsheimer picks up the story at the start of the 20th century, Germany is again aggressive, because by now it controls a larger percentage of the world's industrial might than any other European state. Behind every assertion in this book is a wealth of historical data that helps explain why Tragedy continues, as Richard Betts predicted, to grow in influence. To argue that expansion is inherently misguided, Mearsheimer writes, implies that all great powers over the past 350 years have failed to comprehend how the international system works. This is an implausible argument on its face. The problem with the moderation is good thesis is that it mistakenly equates so-called irrational expansion with military defeat. But hegemony has succeeded many times. The Roman Empire in Europe, the Mughal dynasty in the Indian subcontinent, and the Qing dynasty in China are some of his examples, even as he mentions how Napoleon, Kaiser Wilhelm II, and Adolf Hitler all came close to success. Thus, the pursuit of regional hegemony is not a quixotic ambition, though no state has yet achieved regional hegemony in the Eastern Hemisphere the way the United States achieved it in the Western Hemisphere. The edgiest parts of tragedy are when Mearsheimer presents full-bore rationales for the aggression of Wilhelmine Germany, Nazi Germany, and Imperial Japan. The German decision to push for war in 1914 was not a case of wacky strategic ideas pushing a state to start a war it was sure to lose. It was a calculated risk, motivated in large part by Germany's desire to break its encirclement by the Triple Entente, prevent the growth of Russian power, and become Europe's hegemon. As for Hitler, he did indeed learn from World War I. Hitler learned that Germany could not fight on two fronts at the same time, and he would have to win quick successive victories, which, in fact, he achieved early in World War II. Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor was a calculated risk to avoid abandoning the Japanese Empire in China and Southeast Asia in the face of a U.S. embargo on imported energy and machine tools. Mearsheimer is no warmonger or militarist. His job as a political scientist is not to improve the world, but to say what he thinks is going on in it. And he thinks that while states rightly yearn for a values-based foreign policy, the reality of the anarchic international system forces them to behave according to their own interests. In his view, either liberal internationalism or neoconservatism is more likely than offensive realism to lead to the spilling of American blood. Indeed, because, as some argue, realism in the classical sense seeks the avoidance of war through the maintenance of a balance of power, it is the most humanitarian approach possible. In this vein, fighting Nazi Germany was essential, because the Nazis were attempting to overthrow the European balance of power system altogether. In the course of his 500-plus page defense of his own brand of realism, Mearsheimer popularizes two other concepts, buck passing and the stopping power of water. The latter concept leads Mearsheimer to propose, in 2001, mind you, an American foreign policy of restraint. But first, consider buck passing. Whenever a new great power comes on the scene, one or more states will end up checking it. But every state will initially try to get someone else to do the checking. Buck passing is essentially about who does the balancing, not whether it gets done. The United Kingdom, France, and the Soviet Union all buck passed prior to World War II, each trying to get the other to be the one to bear the brunt of Hitler's onslaught. In Asia today, the United States quietly encourages Japan and India to build up their militaries in order to check China, but in the end, it has no country to whom it can pass the buck. Hence, Mearsheimer's plea from a decade ago that we need to focus on China. The stopping power of water is where tragedy, in an analytical sense, builds toward its powerful conclusion. Large bodies of water are formidable obstacles that cause significant power projection problems, Mearsheimer writes. Great navies and air forces can be built, and soldiers transported to beachheads and airstrips, but conquering great land powers across the seas is difficult. This is why the United States and the United Kingdom have rarely been invaded by other great powers. It is also why the United States has almost never tried to permanently conquer territory in Europe or Asia, and why the United Kingdom has never tried to dominate continental Europe. Therefore, the central aim of American foreign policy is to be the hegemon in the Western Hemisphere only, and to prevent the rise of a similar hegemon in the Eastern Hemisphere. In turn, the proper role for the United States is as an offshore balancer, balancing against the rise of a Eurasian hegemon, and going to war only as a last resort to thwart it. But better to try buck-passing first, Mearsheimer advises, and come into a war only at the last moment when absolutely necessary. Mearsheimer tells me that the United States was right to enter World War II very late. That way it paid a smaller blood price than the Soviet Union. Before D-Day, 93% of all German casualties had occurred on the Eastern Front, he says, adding that the devastation of the Soviet Union helped the United States in the Cold War to follow. How is offshore balancing different from neo-isolationism? I ask him. Isolationists, he responds, believe that there is no place outside of the Western Hemisphere to which it is worth deploying our troops. But offshore balancers believe there are three critical areas that no other hegemon should be allowed to dominate: Europe, the Persian Gulf, and Northeast Asia. Thus, he goes on, it was important to fight Nazi Germany and Japan in World War II. American history suits us to be offshore balancers, not isolationists, not the world's sheriff. Later, when I ask Mearsheimer about the Obama administration's slightly standoffish policies toward Libya and whether they are a good example of buck-passing, he says the problem with leading from behind in this case was that America's European allies lacked the military capacity to do the job efficiently. If mass murder was truly in the offing, as it was in Rwanda, he tells me, then I would have been willing to intervene in Libya. But it is unclear that was the case. Such thinking is prologue to Mearsheimer's admonition that a struggle with China awaits us. The Chinese are good offensive realists, so they will seek hegemony in Asia, he tells me, paraphrasing the conclusion to tragedy. China is not a status quo power. It will seek to dominate the South China Sea, as the United States has dominated the Greater Caribbean Basin. He continues, an increasingly powerful China is likely to try to push the U.S. out of Asia, much the way the U.S. pushed European powers out of the Western Hemisphere. Why should we expect China to act any differently than the United States did? Are they more principled than we are? More ethical? Less nationalistic? On the penultimate page of Tragedy, he warns, neither Wilhelmine Germany, nor Imperial Japan, nor Nazi Germany, nor the Soviet Union had nearly as much latent power as the United States had during their confrontations. But if China were to become a giant Hong Kong, it would probably have somewhere on the order of 4 times as much latent power as the United States does, allowing China to gain a decisive military advantage over the United States. 10 years after those lines were written, China's economy has passed Japan's as the world's second largest. Its total defense spending in 2009 was $150 billion, compared with only $17 billion in 2001. But even more revealing is the pattern of China's military modernization. Force planning, the product of long-term commitments and resource allocation decisions, is the heart of strategy, the military expert Thomas Donnelly of the American Enterprise Institute wrote last year. And for more than a decade now, China's military has shifted its focus from repelling a Soviet invasion and controlling domestic unrest to the sole problem of defeating U.S. forces in East Asia. This has been a strategic surprise to which no American administration has appropriately responded. China is increasing its submarine fleet from 62 to 77, and has tested a stealth fighter jet as part of a build-up also featuring surface warships, missiles, and cyber warfare. Andrew F. Krepinevich, the president of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, believes that nations of the Western Pacific are slowly being Finlandized by China. They will maintain nominal independence, but in the end may abide by foreign policy rules set by Beijing. and the more the United States is distracted by the Middle East, the more it hastens this impending reality in East Asia, which is the geographical heart of the global economy and of the world's navies and air forces. Mearsheimer's critics say that offensive realism ignores ideology and domestic politics altogether. They argue that he takes no account of China's society and economy and where they might be headed. Indeed, simple theories like offensive realism are inherently superficial and wrong in instances. Mearsheimer, for example, is still waiting for NATO to collapse, as he predicted it would in a 1990 Atlantic article. The fact that it hasn't owes as much to the domestic politics of Western states as it does to the objective security situation. And the stopping power of water did not prevent Japan from acquiring a great maritime empire in the early and middle part of the 20th century, nor did it prevent the Allied invasion of Normandy. More generally, Mearsheimer's very cold, mathematical, states-as-billiard-balls approach ignores messy details, like the personalities of Adolf Hitler, Mao Zedong, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and Slobodan Milosevic, that have had a monumental impact in deciding how wars and crises turn out. International relations is as much about understanding Shakespeare and the human passions and intrigues that Shakespeare exposes as it is about understanding political science theories. It matters greatly that Deng Xiaoping was both utterly ruthless and historically perceptive, so that he could set China in motion to become such an economic and military juggernaut in the first place. Manifest Destiny owes as much to the canniness of President James K. Polk as it does to Mearsheimer's laws of historical determinism. But given the limits of social science theories, even as we rely on them to help us make some sense of the Bruegel-esque jumble of history, the tragedy of great power politics is a signal triumph. As Huntington once told his protege Fareed Zakaria, "If you tell people the world is complicated, you're not doing your job as a social scientist. They already know it's complicated. Your job is to distill it, simplify it, and give them a sense of what is the single cause or what are the couple of powerful causes that explain this powerful phenomenon." Truly, Mearsheimer's theory of international relations allowed him to get both Gulf Wars exactly right, and he's one of the few people to do so. As a good offshore balancer, Mearsheimer supported the first Gulf War against Saddam Hussein in 1991. By occupying Kuwait, Iraq had positioned itself as a potential hegemon in the Persian Gulf, justifying U.S. military action. Moreover, as Mearsheimer asserted in several newspaper columns, the United States could easily defeat the Iraqi military. This assertion made him something of a lone wolf in academic circles, where many were predicting a military quagmire or calamity. The Democratic Party, to which most scholars subscribed, overwhelmingly opposed the war. Mearsheimer's confidence that fighting Saddam would be a cakewalk was based in part on his trips to Israel in the 1970s and 80s, when he was studying conventional military deterrence. The Israelis had told him that the Iraqi army, mired as it was in Soviet doctrine, was one of the Arab world's worst militaries. But Mearsheimer's finest hour was the run-up to the second Gulf War against Saddam in 2003. This time, offshore balancing did not justify a war. Iraq was already contained and was not on the brink of becoming the hegemon of the Persian Gulf. And Mearsheimer felt strongly that a new war was a bad idea. He joined with Harvard's Stephen Walt and the University of Maryland's Shibley Tilhami to lead a group of 33 scholars, many of them card-carrying academic realists, to sign a declaration opposing the war. On September 26, 2002, they published an advertisement on the New York Times op-ed page that cost $38,000, and they paid for it themselves. The top of the ad ran, "War with Iraq is not in America's national interest." Among the bullet points was this: "Even if we win easily, we have no plausible exit strategy. Iraq is a deeply divided society that the United States would have to occupy and police for many years to create a viable state. Mearsheimer opposed not only the Iraq War, but also the neoconservative vision of regional transformation, which, as he tells me, was the polar opposite of offshore balancing. He was not against democratization in the Arab world per se, but felt that it should not be attempted and could not be accomplished by an extended deployment of U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. And as he explains to me, he now sees an attack on Iran as yet another distraction from dealing with the challenge of China in East Asia. A war with Iran, he adds, would drive Iran further into the arms of Beijing. During the build-up to the Iraq War, Mearsheimer and Walt began work on what would become a London Review of Books article, and later the Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. The Atlantic had originally commissioned the piece, only to reject it owing to a profound disagreement between the editors and the authors over its objectivity. In some respects, the Israel Lobby reads as an appendix to the tragedy of great power politics, almost a case study of how great powers should not act. Many of those loosely associated with the lobby supported the Iraq War, which Mearsheimer saw as a diversion from the contest with China. The so-called special relationship between the United States and Israel, by further entangling the United States in the problems of the Middle East, contradicted the tenets of offshore balancing, and proponents of the special relationship have routinely justified it by citing Israel's status as a stable democracy in the midst of unstable authoritarian states, but that internal attribute, in Mearsheimer's view, is largely irrelevant. Mearsheimer denies that he co-wrote the book to explain away the contradictions that the U.S.-Israel relationship poses to his larger theory. He wrote it, he says, because the special relationship is a major feature of U.S. foreign policy in its own right. He might also have said that the Israel lobby is an example of how domestic politics do intrude in foreign policy. Thus, his theory of offensive realism is less an explanation of events than an aspiration for how states should behave. He has said elsewhere that the lobby is an anomaly in American history. An anomaly is certainly what his book about it is. Whereas tragedy is a theory, the Israel lobby is a polemic, a tightly organized marshaling of fact and argument that does not necessarily delegitimize Israel, but does delegitimize the American-Israeli special relationship. Lobby lacks the commanding, albeit cruel, objectivity that Mearsheimer evinces in tragedy. It negatively distorts key episodes in Israel's history, beginning with its founding, and in effect denies Israel the license that Mearsheimer grants other countries, including China, to act as good offensive realists. He and Walt equate U.S. support for Israel with Soviet support for Cuba, thereby equating a pulsating democracy with a semi-failed authoritarian state. And while tragedy is rich in explication, lobby is merely tedious, pummeling the reader with lists of names of people and organizations whom the authors group together as advancing the American-Israeli special relationship and the Iraq War, but who in fact often have had profound disagreements among themselves. Meanwhile, the motivations of America's political leaders at the time, the putative targets of the lobby's pressure, and thus the ones best able to assess the lobby's strength, go largely unexplored. This failure to establish a link between the lobby and White House decision-making undermines the book. As the Middle East expert Dennis Ross has suggested, had Al Gore been elected president in 2000, he probably would not have invaded Iraq, even though he had much closer ties to prominent Jews and others in the lobby than did Bush. Nevertheless, the Israel lobby contains a fundamental analytic truth that is undeniable. The United States and Israel, like most states, have some different interests that inevitably push up against any enduring special relationship, especially because their security situations are so vastly different. To start with, The United States is a continent-sized country protected by oceans, while Israel is a small country half a world away, surrounded by enemy states. Because the geographical situations of the United States and Israel are so dissimilar, their geopolitical interests can never completely overlap in the way that Israel's most fervent supporters contend. Iran's nuclear program is a far more acute threat to Israel than it is to the United States. The fact that Israel is a democracy is important, Mearsheimer tells me, but it is not sufficient to justify the terms of the special relationship. We should treat Israel as a normal country, like we treat Britain or Japan. What particularly exasperates Mearsheimer and Walt is the lack of conditionality in the special relationship. They admit that making American support for Israel more conditional would not remove all sources of friction between Arab countries and the United States, nor do they deny the presence of genuine anti-Semitism in various Arab countries. But they cannot condone a situation in which the United States has, over the decades, given Israel more than $180 billion in economic and military assistance, the bulk of it comprising direct grants rather than loans, and yet can barely achieve modest negotiating goals, such as getting Israel to stop expanding West Bank settlements for 90 days, let alone dismantle them, even though the Palestinians have been willing at times to make major concessions. And the United States has been willing to throw in major sweeteners in the form of advanced military hardware. Mearsheimer and Walt repeatedly say in their book that they believe the United States should militarily defend Israel if it is in mortal danger, but that the Israelis must be much more cooperative in light of all the aid they get. But, as they also argue, the reason the Israelis are not more cooperative is that in the final analysis, they don't have to be, which in turn is because of the pro-Israel lobby. Thus, in the spirit of Huntington, the authors distill a complicated situation down to a single powerful cause. I see nothing wrong or illegitimate about this core argument, and no amount of nitpicking by their critics of the Israel lobby's 100 pages of endnotes can detract from it. I say this as someone who is a veteran of the Israel Defense Forces and who supported the Iraq War, a position I have come to deeply regret. Say what you will about the Israel lobby, but as Justine Rosenthal, who is a former editor of The National Interest, a leading foreign policy journal, and is now with Newsweek, told me, it changed the debate on Israel, even if it did not change the policy. She added, "John is one of the clearest logical thinkers I know, who hammers his points home well. Indeed, if you put lobby together with tragedy, you have the beginnings of a prudent grand strategy for America. Invest less in one part of the world and more in another, events permitting." Secretary of State Hillary Clinton recently proposed that the United States should attempt to pivot away from the Middle East toward the Asia-Pacific region, a realization that Mearsheimer came to years ago. On several occasions, Mearsheimer and Walt approvingly bring up the Middle East policy of President Dwight D. Eisenhower, which was more even-handed vis-a-vis Israel and the Arab states. Without being hostile, it lacked the effusive warmth that more recent American presidents have demonstrated toward the Jewish state. When I say to Mearsheimer, "That's the kind of American policy you and Walt really want in the Middle East, isn't it?" he responds, "That's exactly right. Eisenhower came down like a ton of bricks on Britain, France, and Israel, U.S. allies all three, to force them to withdraw from Sinai in 1956. Imagine," he goes on, "if we had Eisenhower in the post-67 period, or now." Mearsheimer's argument is that Eisenhower would have quickly forced Israel out of the occupied territories, and all parties concerned, Israel especially, would have benefited over the long run. No doubt, decades of occupation have fueled hatred of Israel among Egyptians, Jordanians, and others. Given that Israel's electoral system helps assure weak governments, which are beholden in varying degrees to small right-wing parties opposed to substantial territorial withdrawal, Perhaps the only chance Israel has of not becoming an apartheid society is if an American president finds the gumption to adopt an Eisenhower-esque approach and force Israel to withdraw from significant portions of the West Bank, wrangling Palestinian concessions in the process. You don't have to trust me, Steve Walt, or Jimmy Carter. Just listen to former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, whose November 28, 2007 statement Mearsheimer quotes to me. If the day comes when the two-state solution collapses and we face a South African-style struggle for equal voting rights, then as soon as that happens, the state of Israel is finished. Moreover, the revolt against calcified central authority in the Middle East, while in the long run beneficial to the emergence of more liberal regimes, may, in the short and middle term, yield more chaotic and more populist ones, which will create more rather than fewer security problems for Israel. The cost to Israel of its unwillingness to make territorial concessions will grow rather than diminish. Even as Mearsheimer is attacked, whenever he publishes something, a recent book on why diplomats are forced to lie, or a recent essay decrying both liberal and neoconservative imperialism, he breaks new ground. A collection of his critics' academic essays published in 2010, History and Neorealism, takes aim at Mearsheimer's theories in tragedy. Some of the criticism is scathing, proving that Mearsheimer is the political science world's enfant terrible, much more because of tragedy than because of the Israel lobby. The essayists attack his theory for its lack of historical subtlety, but here too, like Huntington, Mearsheimer is setting the terms of the debate. Despite the media controversy that surrounded the Israel lobby, his latest book, Why Leaders Lie, 2011, attracted generous jacket blurbs from academic eminences such as the Princeton professor Robert O. Cohane and former editors of both Foreign Affairs and Foreign Policy. Within media ranks, the Israel lobby has delegitimized Mearsheimer. Inside the Service Academy, where I taught for 2 years, in the think tank world where I work, and in various government circles with which I am acquainted, Mearsheimer is quietly held in higher regard because of familiarity with his other books. But the controversy, and its echoes last fall, has surely hurt him. Mearsheimer, who is not modest, believes it is a reliance on theory that invigorates his thinking. Returning to his principal passion, China, he tells me, "I have people all the time telling me that they've just returned from China and met with all these Chinese who want a peaceful relationship. I tell them that these Chinese will not be in power in 20 or 30 years, when circumstances may be very different. Because we cannot know the future, all we have to rely upon is theory. If a theory can explain the past in many instances, as my theory of offensive realism can, it might be able to say something useful about the future. And it is likely to be China's future, rather than Israel's, that will ultimately determine Mearsheimer's reputation. If China implodes from a socioeconomic crisis, or evolves in some other way that eliminates its potential as a threat, Mearsheimer's theory will be in serious trouble because of its dismissal of domestic politics. But if China goes on to become a great military power, reshaping the balance of forces in Asia, then Mearsheimer's tragedy will live on as a classic. Reflections. 13. On foreign policy, Donald Trump is no realist. The Washington Post, November 13, 2016. President-elect Donald Trump is being called a realist in foreign policy. Don't believe it. He may have some crude realist instincts, but that only makes him a terrible messenger for realism. Realists like myself should be very nervous about his election. Realism is a sensibility, not a specific guide to what to do in each crisis, and it is a sensibility rooted in a mature sense of the tragic, of all the things that can go wrong in foreign policy, so that caution and a knowledge of history are embedded in the realist mindset. Realism has been with us at least since Thucydides wrote the Peloponnesian War in the 5th century BC, in which he defined human nature as driven by fear, phobos, self-interest, kerdos, and honor, doxa. Because the realist knows that he must work with such elemental forces rather than against them, he also knows, for example, that order comes before freedom and interests come before values. After all, without order, there is no freedom for anybody, and without interests, a state has no incentive to project its values. Trump has given no indication that he has thought about any of this. He appears to have no sense of history, and therefore no mature sense of the tragic. A sense of history comes mainly from reading. That's how we know in the first place about such things as our obligations to allies and our role as the defender of the West. All previous presidents in modern times, without being intellectuals, have been readers to some extent. But Trump seems post-literate, a man who has made an end run around books directly to the digital age, where nothing is vetted, context is absent, and lies proliferate. Realists worship truth, for the ultimate lesson of history is that the truth of situations is often unpleasant. But Trump's statements throughout the campaign have repeatedly revealed a basic disregard of facts. Realists know that while the balance of power is not a panacea, maintaining an advantageous balance of power with rivals is generally in a nation's interest. Russian President Vladimir Putin has upset the balance of power from Central Europe to the Middle East, something that we need urgently to rectify, at the very least for the sake of a stronger negotiating position with Russia. Trump appears to have no understanding of this. Indeed, rather than being realistic, his benign statements about Putin are dangerously naive. Realists know that because values follow interests and not the other way around, a free trading regime in Asia gives us a greater stake in the region so that we have more incentive to project our values there. A free trading regime among our allies also counters China's overbearing influence, which Trump claims he wants to curtail, but, because he is not a realist, has no responsible idea about how to do it. Realism is about moderation. It sees the value in the status quo, while idealists only see the drawbacks in it. It is, therefore, wary of change. Trump, by contrast, wants an upheaval in the international system, from sparking trade wars to increasing tensions with Mexico to undermining NATO. Admitting the Baltic states into NATO may not have been altogether prudent from a realist point of view, but now that they are in the alliance, the credibility of NATO and of the West depends on defending them. Trump and his supporters clearly do not grasp this. Realism, again, because it is a sensibility and not a strategy, must be merged with a historically accurate vision of America's place in the world. That place is no better defined than by the location of the Holocaust Memorial Museum adjacent to the mall, showing that the Holocaust, which happened to Jews in Europe, has been by consensus granted entry into our national consciousness. This does not mean that the United States must intervene every time there is a major human rights violation somewhere, for that would be unrealistic. But it does mean that it must always take notice and, when practical, participate in a response, because America's duty emerging out of the crucible of World War II and the Cold War has been to try, wherever possible, to expand the boundaries of civil society worldwide. Idealists are obsessed with this. Realists are not. Realists know that national interest comes before any global interest. But realists too, at least the respectable kind, harbor an internationalist vision. History moves on. World War II and the Cold War recede. But the United States is the most well-endowed and advantageously located major state on Earth. That good fortune comes with responsibilities that extend beyond our own borders. Just look at the size of our 300-warship Navy and the location of our aircraft carriers on any given week. Realism is about utilizing such power to protect allies without precipitating conflict. It is not about abandoning them and precipitating conflict as a consequence. Hopefully, Trump will become a realist, but he has a long way to go. 14. The Post-Imperial Moment. The National Interest, May 2016. In 1935, the anti-Nazi writer and Austrian Jewish intellectual Joseph Roth published a story, The Bust of the Emperor, about an elderly count at the chaotic fringe of the former Habsburg Empire, who refused to think of himself as a Pole or an Italian, even though his ancestry encompassed both. In his mind, the only mark of true nobility was to be a man above nationality in the Habsburg tradition. My old home, the monarchy, alone, the count says, was a great mansion with many doors and many chambers for every condition of men. Indeed, the horrors of 20th century Europe, Roth wrote presciently, had as their backdrop the collapse of empires and the rise of uni-ethnic states, with fascists and communist leaders replacing the power of traditional monarchs. Empire clearly had its evils, but one cannot deny its historical function, to provide stability and order to vast tracts of land occupied by different peoples. If not empire, what then? In fact, though very few will admit it, a rules-based international system and the raft of supranational and multinational groupings such as the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, European Union, International Monetary Fund, International Court of Justice, World Economic Forum, and so on, are all attempts to replace, to greater and lesser extents, the function of empire. Silently undergirding this process since World War II has been the undeniable fact of American power, military, diplomatic, and economic, protecting the sea lanes, the maritime choke points, and access to hydrocarbons, and in general providing some measure of security to the world. These tasks are amoral to the extent that they do not involve lofty principles, but without them, there is no possibility for moral action anywhere. This is not traditional imperialism, which is no longer an option, but it is the best available replacement for it. However, while the United States still remains the single strongest power on the globe, it is less and less an overwhelming one. The diffusion of central authority in new democracies everywhere, the spread of chaos in the Middle East and North Africa, and the rise of Russia, China, and Iran as regional hegemons all work to constrain the projection of American power. This is part of a process that has been going on for a century. At the end of World War I, formal multi-ethnic empires in Europe, those of the Habsburgs and Ottomans, crumbled. At the end of World War II, the overseas empires of the British and French began to do the same. The end of the Cold War heralded the collapse of the Soviet Empire in Eastern Europe and parts of Eurasia. The early 21st century witnessed the collapse or erosion of post-imperial strongmen in Iraq, Syria, Libya, and elsewhere, men who ruled absolutely within artificial borders erected by European imperialists. The American Empire of sorts, that is, the last power standing whose troops and diplomats have found themselves in an imperial-like situation, is now giving way too. This partial retreat of American power has international and domestic causes. On the international front, vast urbanization, absolute rises in population, and natural resource scarcities, as well as the rise of individual consciousness thanks to the communications revolution, have subtly eroded the power of central authority everywhere. The United States just cannot influence the decisions of individual countries the way it used to. Meanwhile, the maturation of both violent millennial movements and regional hegemons are direct threats to U.S. power projection. On the domestic front, the Obama administration wishing to transform American society, has deliberately avoided major entanglements overseas and has sought to ameliorate relations with adversaries, principally Iran. This is a sign of imperial fatigue, a good thing, arguably, but something that nevertheless works to constrain U.S. power rather than to project it. The United States is signaling that it will less and less be providing world order, in other words. Rather than exclusively the philosophical work of one president, I suspect that this development is the beginning of a new phase in American foreign policy, following the hyperactivity of World War II and the Cold War, and their long aftershocks in the Balkans and the Middle East. Driving this relative retrenchment in Washington are social and economic turmoil at home and intractable complexity and upheaval abroad. Again, I am not saying that this is a wise course for the United States, but I am saying that it is real, and it is happening. Because it is happening, and because of the economic, environmental, and social disruptions I have alluded to above, world disorder will only grow. The weakening and dissolution of small and medium-sized states in Africa and the Middle East will advance to quasi-anarchy in larger states on which the geographic organization of Eurasia hinges, namely Russia and China. For the external aggression of these new regional hegemons is in part motivated by internal weakness, as they employ nationalism to assuage unraveling domestic economies upon which the stability of their societies rests. Then there is the European Union, which, if not crumbling, is surely weakening. Rather than a unified and coherent superstate, Europe will increasingly be a less than coherent confection of states and regions as it dissolves internally and also externally into the fluid geography of Eurasia, the Levant, and North Africa, demonstrated by Russian revanchism and the demographic assault of Muslim refugees. Of course, on a longer time horizon, there is technology itself. As the strategist T.X. Hammes points out, the convergence of cheap drones, cyber warfare, 3D printing, and so on, will encourage the diffusion of power among many states and stateless groups, rather than the concentration of it into a few imperial-like hands. We are entering an age of what I call comparative anarchy, that is, a much higher level of anarchy compared to that of the Cold War and post-Cold War periods. After all, globalization and the communications revolution have reinforced, rather than negated, geopolitics. The world map is now smaller and more claustrophobic, so that territory is more ferociously contested, and every regional conflict interacts with every other as never before. A war in Syria is inextricable from a terrorist outrage in France, even as Russia's intervention in Syria affects Europe's and America's policies toward Ukraine. This happens at a moment when, as I've said, multinational empires are gone, as are most totalitarian regimes in artificially drawn states where official borders do not configure with ethnic and sectarian ones. The upshot is a maelstrom of national and subnational groups in violent competition. And so, geopolitics, the battle for space and power, now occurs within states as well as between them. Cultural and religious differences are particularly exacerbated, for as group differences melt down in the crucible of globalization, they have to be artificially reinvented in more blunt and ideological form by, as it turns out, the communications revolution. It isn't the clash of civilizations so much as the clash of artificially reconstructed civilizations that is taking place. Witness the Islamic State, which does not represent Islam per se, but Islam igniting with the tyrannical conformity and mass hysteria inspired by the internet and social media. The postmodern reinvention of identities only hardens geopolitical divides. In the course of all this, technology is not erasing geography, it is sharpening it. Just look at China and India. For most of history, with exceptions like the spread of Buddhism in antiquity and the 19th century opium wars, China and India had relatively little to do with each other, emerging as two civilizations separated by the Himalayas. But technological advances have collapsed distance. Indian intercontinental ballistic missiles can reach Chinese cities, and Chinese fighter jets